We are thrilled to be back in 2023 with Bill Kareach, who is literally one of the more interesting people that I have met in my travels through education. Thrilled to have him here with us today. Bill, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Hello, Stacy. I'm excited to be here talking with you.
And we're excited to have you. You know, you and I met through Tammy Workman, who is our educator in chief at CWK Network. And she worked with you, had the pleasure of working with you at Atlanta Public Schools. And so when she first introduced me to you and told me what you were doing, I was fascinated because I think that most people don't know a lot about the role that you played in Atlanta Public Schools and in school systems throughout the country, throughout your history. And I'm not going to give it away. I'm going to let you talk a little bit about it and tell us a little bit about yourself and your background. But I think it's important for our listeners to know that what you do actually has quite a bit of application and can be very helpful as a backdrop and in helping understand what actually goes on in schools, particularly in the times that we're living in, where we are so polarized and there's so much debate about what we're teaching our children in the classroom and why. So let's start there. And let's talk a little bit first, if you could give a little background on who you are and how you came to be where you are now, which is really working with districts and folks across the country to provide solutions for, quote, fixing our city schools.
Well, let's see, a little bit about myself. I grew up in New York. My parents had a small luncheonette business, and so my brother and my sister and I started working from the time we were in elementary school, running the cash register and stocking shelves and those sorts of things. So we learned to work hard pretty early on. And of course, I went to college. I thought I was going to be a baseball player, so I went to the University of Virginia to be in warmer weather, get out of New York. And of course, I was very fortunate. I didn't play a lot of baseball, but I was very fortunate to wind up in education. I've worked in 9 school districts around the country. I started in Virginia in a couple of smaller, sort of medium-sized districts. And then I had the great fortune to start working in some of our biggest cities. So I've worked in the St. Louis City Public Schools, the Baltimore Public Schools, the Department of Defense school system, which was a very interesting, different experience. And then most recently, Austin, Texas, and Atlanta, Georgia. So it's been a very interesting and exciting career. The org chart, the official org chart, and the informal org chart are always two very different things. And so I've done a little bit of everything. I've done standards alignment. I was in charge of school improvement when I worked for the Department of Defense. I even chaired the Special Ed Advisory Committee in Austin, Texas, although I have very little background in special education. So, you know, you never know exactly what people are going to ask you to do or why, but I've had a lot of exciting work. I've worked with literally thousands of educators, principals, assistant superintendents, superintendents. So over the years, you know, I've been very fortunate, and my primary background was always in assessment. That's what I started in. I was in IT for a little bit, and then for many years I was the data guy. I was the assessment person. So I did evaluation, program evaluation, research, accountability, testing, and all the data for the data system, for the school system. The last 10 years or so in Austin and then in Atlanta, I also did IT, so that was a bit of a full circle for me, going back to where I kind of started many, many years ago in doing information technology. And then I had the good fortune in Atlanta to also supervise instructional technology, which of course was when the pandemic closed our schools a couple of years ago. Those were the divisions that were really instrumental in keeping us going and making sure that kids had great experiences, even though they had to be at home.
So Bill, you've served in so many roles, but I think, and like you said, the org chart, how it looks on paper and what really happens in real life, you know, sort of like inside a company.
Right.
You know, you sort of pick up the pieces and do different things and learn different things just being immersed in the culture and the day-to-day exercise of making something grow and run, and particularly with you serving so many students. But I want to first address a couple of things from your role in assessment and working with administrators. And I want to address a couple of myths, especially in our changing, complex, and interesting times. Number one, there seems to be a notion that teachers kind of teach what they want, that it's open season in schools in terms of what I teach in my classroom, what I can and can't teach in my classroom, that somehow I show up every day with my personal attitudes and beliefs, and that's my teaching strategy. And I want you to, I'm oversimplifying this, obviously, and being a little bit sarcastic, but I want you to talk a little bit about all the checks and balances that are or should be, some probably better districts better at it than others, some schools better at it than others, that we have in place in the American education system and in the public schools to actually not, it's not open season. It's not a free for all. School systems have to abide by and do for the most part and take very seriously in what is being taught to students.
Yeah, that, I mean, there's a few pieces to that question. So let me see if I can sort of pull it apart a little bit. First, you have state standards. An awful lot depends on how good the standards are. You may remember the TIMSS study of many years ago that was done comparing the United States to other countries. And the famous sort of phrase now, a mile wide and an inch deep. And that, unfortunately, is too often the case with state standards in the United States. So teachers are sort of limited a little bit just from the beginning. And then, of course, they know they have the state tests. Virtually every state has a test at the end of the year. Their performance is going to be judged on how well the students do on the summative high stakes test. And so they're, you know, feel compelled to sort of stay in their lane a little bit and make sure that they cover the famous phrase, cover the curriculum, quote unquote. So that's kind of where they start. And of course, then the second piece of it, as you mentioned already, is it depends on the school. Some principals give teachers a lot of latitude and some principals don't. I think the unfortunate thing is that too often where the kids are, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And the teachers feel this pressure to keep moving on, even though they know a lot of the kids in their class aren't ready to move on. So I think that's kind of the tension. You know, hopefully in most cases, teachers do have some flexibility.
So Bill, we're living in a very confusing time, a complex time. Public trust of public institutions, statistics show, is way down. Our public education system is something that is large and cumbersome and difficult to manage and maneuver at times, but it is the system that we have, and that the lion's share of our children who will be the future of America go to get an education. And I think for many families, it's the only option out there. And what I'd like to do is hear from you as somebody who has a broad look at different administrations in public schools and school districts across the nation, and has been in a lot of different roles. And as I like to say, has been sort of in the weeds and behind the scenes and in the details, which is where we find a lot of things out. You know, for those who are questioning what we're actually teaching our kids in schools, what protections do I have as a parent that I can maybe breathe a sigh of relief that it's going to be okay in our public schools? And what things I need to be looking for and questioning in my public schools when we see the debates about CRT and social and emotional learning and, you know, don't say gay and all the things that are going on and all the things that are happening legislatively to restrict speech between teachers and students. What kind of, you know, perspective can you give us on that?
Well, certainly from the seat where I came from for so many years, the last 40 years, close to the superintendent's office, you have superintendents who are, you know, they want to be by the book. They really do get nervous about getting into areas with that's going to cause pushback, either for them personally or just for their school system in more generally. And then you have superintendents who are going to fight, who are going to push back. And certainly the ones I've worked for a couple for many years who were very tough. You know, unfortunately, the reality is that tends to get them in trouble eventually. But, you know, the last thing that a superintendent wants is for the staff to bring problems to them. The same is true of school boards, I assume. The last thing school boards want is for a superintendent to cause them all kinds of trouble. That's the bad news. I think the good news is that teachers, when they close their doors, most teachers have an awful lot of freedom to teach, whether it's social studies or science or math. Now, there's certainly areas that I think are going to be, that it's going to be very frustrating for teachers. And I think it's another one of those things today that's pushing teachers out the door. You know, we have a hard time keeping great teachers as it is. They work long hours. They work hard. They're on their feet all day long. I think one of the things that the public does not appreciate fully, I mean, we say these things, you know, we always say, oh, I love my teachers and the teachers are great and all these nice things. I don't think the public has any idea how hard the job is. And I can say that from somebody who observed somewhat from the outside for many, many years. I was in a school in Atlanta about 3 or 4 years ago, and we had a program using Chromebooks. And so we were distributing Chromebooks in elementary schools. And so I got to spend a lot of time in schools for a couple of weeks. And I was in a classroom watching a teacher she had about 20 first graders. And she was great. She was one of those great teachers. You know, you just think, wow, I'd love for my kids to have a teacher like that. She was articulate. She was smart. She was well-prepared, organized, was engaging, trying to engage every student. And I remember after we left the room, I turned to the executive director for instructional technology who was in the room with me. And I turned to her and I said, I couldn't do that. I don't know how people do it. I mean, I literally would be exhausted at the end of the day. And unfortunately, so many of our young teachers are just, they're feeling that. And they're going like, I can do something else. I don't have to put up with all these restrictions. And unfortunately, we lose too many teachers that way. But I think the large majority of teachers close their doors and do what they think is the right thing. And, you know, they're teaching science or they're teaching world history or they're teaching reading. They don't have time to worry about the politics, is my guess. Once they get in there every day, I mean, they're busy going home, getting a lesson plan ready for the next day, and then doing it all over again.
Can we talk a little bit about standards and evidence-based designations around curricula? So there is no standard for social and emotional learning. There's no standard for how you talk about sensitive topics or difficult to talk about topics. There's a math standard. There's a state standard for math. There's a state standard for reading at a grade level. We don't see state standards yet. Some states are actually implementing SEL standards, but for the most part, we don't see these kinds of standards for these social, emotional, social action, justice, you know, diversity, inclusion, all these things that we're talking about in schools now. There are something called evidence-based curricula. There are ways to know whether or not curricula is effective. But how do you see the landscape changing? And are you concerned at all about corporate America coming in and companies coming in and trying to make money off of digital technologies that we're putting into the classroom? I mean, this is really your area, where we're, you know, testing kids for whether or not little Johnny was depressed today or whether or not he had got a smiley face. And what do we do next in terms of trying to help Johnny with that when I'm a math teacher and not a counselor? Do you have concerns about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, and I write about this a lot in my newsletters and also in the book that I've been working on, is that too often we jump from one shiny object to another. And I think there is a danger that, you know, we will be influenced by whether it's corporations or politics to sort of try one program. And then if that program doesn't work, we jump to another program. And I don't know where that goes with some of these social issues today. You know, we always talk about how we can't be shocked anymore. And the reality is we still are all the time. And we just think, well, how is that possible that we're getting this kind of challenge to what teachers are allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do? On the technology side, to tell you the truth, if you remember, I don't know how many years ago now, gosh, it's got to be 40 years ago. You know, we thought television was going to be this great thing. We were going to use television to do all these wonderful things. And I don't think it was ever used nearly as effectively as it could have been. And unfortunately, I see the same thing in technology. There's a lot of great technology. And I'm sure if you go out to Silicon Valley out in California, I'm sure there's some schools out there doing amazing things, or not just in Silicon Valley, but in some districts around the country doing amazing things with technology. I don't think that's the norm. And so one of my frustrations is we have all these kids who are struggling to learn to read and do basic math skills. And we have this tool that could be used to let children practice at home during rotations. And I don't think we use it very effectively. Similarly, and I hate to tell negative stories, but I'll tell you a story very quickly. I was in a high school in Austin, and there was a group of us. The superintendent was with us, and we were visiting classrooms in this particular high school that was one of the schools that the state of Texas had identified as a low performing school. And we were in a physics classroom, and the teacher was this, couldn't have been a nicer lady. And she was teaching a lesson on crash tests. And so she was showing a video of this very brief crash test video. And at the end of the video, she turned on the lights and she said, okay, I want you to write down three things you saw in the crash test about gravity. I was in engineering school before I became an educator. And so I know a little bit about classic physics. And there's really not a lot in a crash test video that has to do with gravity. So I was curious and I thought, well, there's got to be some wonderful videos out there that people have put together, these wonderful lessons. Has about a 20-minute video, educational video on crash tests, all about Newton's first laws and second laws and so forth. There's wonderful things that teachers could be using, and I think too often they don't. And in this particular case, this was a teacher who clearly, she may not even been certified in physics. So she may be just filling in for somebody. So, you know, I think there's good things about technology and there's bad things about technology. We certainly don't want to turn all of education over to some sort of rote computer program. On the other hand, there's a lot of great things that technology could be doing that we're not taking full advantage of.
You said you write about a lot of these issues consistently in the work that you're doing. And one of the things that you're doing is really under the umbrella of large urban schools and urban school districts. And how do we, quote, fix some of the serious problems in large urban cities, particularly when we're dealing with marginalized populations? I mean, as we know, historically, marginalized populations have been left behind to a large degree by the public school system and have not been served in the way that some others have. Tell me what you've identified is strong. What are we doing right? And what are some of the key things that we're doing wrong and that you feel like are fixable with certain solutions? You
know, the great news is that for many years, public schools have been doing many, many great things. They've been on the right track. I mean, if you look back at almost every reform, I may take reading as an exception to that rule, and we can talk about that in a moment. But in my particular area, formative assessments, RTI and the use of universal screeners, wraparound services, stipends to recruit and keep teachers in underserved schools, after school, before school, summer school. I mean, the list goes on and on. SEL, better data systems where teachers are able to get data within minutes of giving a quiz or using a universal screener. Data dashboards so the public has a lot more information than what they used to have right at their fingertips if they have a computer. Reading specialists, and I could go on, the list goes on and on. And when you step back from all that and you say, well, why is it that so many kids aren't learning to read? And why are so many kids not going to college and being successful at college and so forth? You know, the first thing that I think you have to recognize is those are all common sense solutions. I mean, this, you know, after school, before school, summer school, perfectly logical things to do. Hire more and more coaches and specialists, perfectly logical, common sense strategies. And so the question is, why aren't those things that you don't want to discard? It's not that we should throw those things out. All those things, even combined, if you look at Black and brown children, for example, 20% of them scoring proficient or above on their local state test. And almost half of those kids are still scoring at the lowest level on fourth grade reading and fourth grade math. Why is that? If you're doing all these great things and you're on the right track, why isn't it all adding up? And so there's a few things that I talk a lot about when I'm talking to districts and when I write my newsletters. And the first place to start, of course, is literacy. If you look at the data for fourth graders, about 20% of the kids in large urban school districts scoring proficient or above in reading and math, and you look at the percentage who persist and graduate from college, those percentages are almost exactly the same. Only about 20% of the kids in our large urban schools don't drop out, graduate, go to college, and then persist for 4 or 5 years to get a degree. It's only about 20%.
That is mind-blowing to me that that number is so low. What you're saying, let me restate this, is that in most urban systems, the majority of urban school systems, about 20% of the population actually graduates and makes it through college with a diploma.
That's right. I mean, if you do the math, it's not complicated. Roughly, depending on what city you're in, 70 or 80% of the kids persist and graduate. 20, 30% drop out. So those kids they're not going to college. They've already given up on public schools for whatever reason. Percentage of those then enter college in the fall. And I forget the exact percentage, but it's something like 60% or something like that. But that's 60% of the ones who graduated, not the ones who dropped out. And of those, 5 years later, only about 20%. Now, some of it's financial. They can't afford to stay. Certainly some of them will come back later on and perhaps finish, but it's a shocking number. It's a shockingly low number in a world where, you know, education is so important to being successful. And so the first place to start is literacy. And we do lots of good things in literacy. And I write about this a lot. It's one of the areas that I myself underestimated what it takes. So let's just back up for a second and just talk a little bit about literacy, early literacy. Everybody's now talking about the science of reading. And some of us have been talking about that since the reading panels of 20, 30 years ago. But now it's sort of the hot topic. Not everybody's implementing, but people are certainly talking about it. And many districts are implementing the science of reading. I think it's a great step in the right direction. And of course, that requires teacher training. That goes without saying. You can't implement anything new without teacher training. And certainly you want an engaged principal. And so those three things, you would think those three things combined, you'd be on the right track. And what I've found in talking to successful principals is they tell me that's not enough. The level of implementation those principals applied is above and beyond anything that you normally see when you implement a new program. These are principals who are actively engaged in what's going on in the classroom all the time. They are doing training themselves. In one case, for example, one of the requirements that the school had was that students would have a portfolio of writing work and math problem-solving assignments. And this was a rule. It was one of the few things that was required in that school. You know, the core curriculum, the teachers were given a lot of flexibility, but that was a requirement, one of three requirements that the school had. And those portfolios were checked by the principal himself. And this was two schools that did the same thing. It was actually a husband and wife team, and they did it exactly the same way. And the principal told me, he said, if I went in there and the assignments weren't assigned or the students weren't doing well at the assignment, you know, I had a conversation about how that could be done better. And he said, you didn't have to have too many of those conversations before people kind of figured out what the principal expected. And I won't get into the other two, but the other, certainly, well, the other one that was the critical one was the gaps that kids bring with them to school.
Right.
So,
right. Yeah.
I don't remember the year. I think it's quite a few years ago. Harton and Risley did their study where they said there was a gap of 32 million words by age 4. And there's been debate whether it's 32 million words or 20 million words or 5 million words or 10 million
whatever.
Words.
It's a pretty significant gap.
Right.
But let's step back on the reading issue for just a minute, and then I'm going to let you go through a couple of the other issues that we need to be talking about. But reading is so incredibly important to level the playing field, and having a grasp of and a use of language. I mean, I think people kind of know that, you know, intuitively. And if somebody's probably everybody saying, well, you know, you're stating the obvious. Well, sure. But I don't think people think about what it means for a four-year-old who has that gap that never really can catch up. What does it do to perpetuate inequity if I do not have a level playing field with my counterparts, my peers, in literacy/reading?
Now, there's certainly kids who come with other disabilities. I mean, there are certainly kids who are going to struggle. So this doesn't apply to every kid. But this is, to me, has always been the number one equity issue. I mean, I've been in a lot of conversations with the senior team around equity and, you know, transfer policies, open enrollment policies, stipends for teachers. All those things, again, are great ideas. There's nothing wrong with those ideas, and I totally support them. But if kids don't learn to read and do basic math by third, fourth grade, they never catch up. And so the question is, what do you do about that? You know, I think it's unfortunate that in all the years that I've been in public schools, it's rare that you hear somebody come to a public meeting and get up at the microphone and say, I demand that this happen. It's as if you believe that my kid is poor, and because he's poor, he can't learn to read. He can't do basic math. And as a principal once said to me, he said, this is not rocket science. We're teaching third graders to read and do basic math. And it doesn't matter to me what neighborhood they come from. Doesn't matter to me what language is their first language. They're always catching up. I mean, I'm not naive. They're always catching up. There are kids who are going to come to school ahead of everybody else. I'm a bit of a talker, so I have two children. You know, my children were ready to go probably when they hit kindergarten. And, you know, they probably had that advantage built in. In my estimation, there are very few children out there who can't learn to do the basic reading and math skills required. As principals will tell you, you can't access the core curriculum without those skills.
Okay, so this gets really interesting, because to some degree, we may be having the wrong conversation in this country in terms of where our focus is and what we really need to be talking about, what is going on in schools and what we're getting them to. However, the politics of the day, you know, you hear a lot of people say, let's just send them to school and teach them reading and math, exactly what you're saying. You know, let's not focus on all this other stuff. We got to get these kids to read, right? And if we can get them to read, a lot of the other problems get solved along the way. The other school of thought is if I haven't had breakfast, if I haven't been cared for, if my basic needs are not met, if I don't feel like I belong, if I feel like I'm outside of the system that is trying to educate me, you can't teach me to read because I'm not, quote, ready to learn as a young child. So what do you say about those two different kind of perspectives?
Children have a lot of needs, and certainly, you know, our food, our nutrition programs probably could be better, but it's something we spend an awful lot of time and money trying to get right in public schools. I said earlier that I think people underestimate how difficult it is to be a teacher. I don't think people have any idea how difficult and committed most superintendents are. By my count, I've worked with 20 superintendents over the years. And even the ones that I thought were not great superintendents, they all worked really hard. And they all wanted to do the right things and tried to do the right things. I think that's on the plus side. I'll tell you an anecdote on the social-emotional side. I was in a principal meeting in Austin, goes back a few years now. And I was early to the meeting. It was a principal's meeting in a big auditorium at one of our schools. And I was early and I was sitting in the auditorium by myself while the principals were in the hall talking to friends they hadn't seen in a couple of months and doing a little socializing before the meeting started. And I was sitting there and the principal of Lamar Middle School came in, big, tall fellow who was brand new to Lamar. He'd been the assistant principal at the Performing Arts High School for many years and had just gotten his first principalship at Lamar Middle. That was the feeder school to this Performing Arts School. And he sat down next to me and it didn't take him a couple of minutes before he started chewing me out about the testing program, because I was the head of the testing department. And he was just really thought the testing was terrible and that it had some negative things. And he was being very specific about some of the things that we were doing that he thought needed to be done differently. And at the end of a brief conversation, he said to me, "I want my children to leave my school every day feeling like they've had a good day." And you know, even I was taken aback and thought, wow, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. You know, you take it for granted. And so it doesn't matter where the kids are. Doesn't matter whether they're the top student or, you know, a student that struggles. Doesn't matter what neighborhood they come from. I mean, in my mind, that is a minimum expectation that to the extent that it's humanly possible, those kids should leave every day feeling like school's a place that they were safe, where they were treated respectfully, where they hopefully got a good lunch and maybe a good breakfast, and where they make progress. Again, great schools focus on progress. They know kids are going to move more slowly. Some are going to move more slowly than others, but they can't race them through the curriculum. Great schools don't do that. Everybody else does it, but the great schools don't do it.
Well, look, it was great to see you today. Great to have you and really fascinating. I'm always, you know, years and years ago as a journalist, producer, director, I had a executive producer when I was in my 20s say to me, you know, Stacy, always try to understand whether or not you can tell people something they don't know or give them a new way of looking at something that they believe they know. And I think, Bill, you do both. I think you give us a new lens, a new perspective that we don't often hear about in mainstream media, which often is just so cyclical and so repeats itself just over and over again. You're looking for something fresh and interesting and new to hear. And I think you give us a perspective with how deep you have been in school systems and how many different people you have worked with that we just don't have access to.
Probably aren't many people who have worked in 9 public school districts in the country for 40 years.
Right, exactly. So we appreciate your expertise. We appreciate you sharing your time with us today. And we encourage everyone to go to the podcast notes after the podcast. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Appreciate you being here.